Good morning, good day, or good evening, whenever you are listening to this. My name is Kevin Fukunaga, and you've joined the Scripts and Scribes Social. Thanks for spending a little of your quarantine time with us today. I'm joined today by an old friend who's been on the podcast a number of times. He is a writer-producer who created the shows Extant, and he also created Reverie on NBC, which was fantastic. My wife actually gave me a crew shirt for that, and my wife wore it just the other day, announcing the laundry.
It needs to be That's clean. So nice.
He's also worked on everything from The Strain to Mars. He is the hero of Ironton, Ohio, Mickey Fisher. Thanks for coming on again, Mickey.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so it's been a long time since we've seen each other. So what's been going on in your world?
I guess so. Last time I talked to you was probably Reverie had ended. Maybe it was still airing at the time, because I think we were in my little, like, I had rented a small office over in Glendale, because over the course of a couple of years, like, you start collecting toys and artwork and things like that, and I didn't really have a place to put them in the house, so I rented one of those, like, it wasn't like WeWork, but one of those Regis spaces over in Glendale, like, so I could just have a little place to go, because I tend to like writing outside of the house as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So I think that was going on then. And so I think since then I've been on a couple of things. I sold a pitch to Apple for something that I don't know if I can really talk about it yet or not. Cause it's not been ordered to move forward or anything. But I spent most of the last year working on that. And then I did a couple, I've done a couple sort of mini rooms for things that are still in development. Again, sort of things you can't talk about. So I've been staying busy, but I also spent most of last year, my girlfriend and I, we bought a house in Glendale. So a lot of 2019 was just about, like, settling in and getting used to the house and the neighborhood and all that kind of, we didn't have a whole lot of stuff to do to it. But one of the things I did do, first off, was there was a single car garage that I converted into an office. So now I have all those toys and books and things at home, which is where I'm talking to you now. So I have a space here at home to write from, which is where I'm spending a lot of my quarantine time.
Hmm. We'll have to do another office tour. If you haven't seen Mickey's previous office tour with all his goodies, it's on our YouTube page, so you can check that out.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I'll have to give you maybe I'll shoot you a few pictures of this too. I did add a couple things when I moved in, because now I have, like, my whole bookcase with a lot of the toys and stuff, and then my TV. But I also bought a pinball machine, which is a Williams Space Odyssey pinball machine, and it's from the 70s, and it's one of those. It was actually the artwork on it, and the title Space Odyssey was popular for a very brief period of time, and then they got a swift cease and desist order from the studio from 2001, A Space Odyssey. And so they had to change the name and change the artwork to it. So I have one of the original ones. It's actually a Space Odyssey, and it's really like the older sort of 70s, more tactile pinball machines. Mm-hmm. And I love it. It's like I play it every single day, pretty much. It's a little bit like my therapy in that, you know, just in a sense of like or like those independent activities where in the middle of writing, I can take a break for 15, 20. It's standing, which is good. It makes me like it's a standing activity. For 15, 20 minutes, half hour, I can play and just zone out and let my subconscious mind wander. It's great. And then I also got a Space Invaders cabinet because it was one of my favorite games from my childhood. Unfortunately, it worked the very first day I bought it, and then the screen went jittery, and I've had a hard time getting it repaired to where it actually stays working for a long period of time. Oh. So I have it's kind of like part office, part game room, part movie room. We did a lot of Game of Thrones parties out here, that sort of thing.
Nice. Well, I see that a lot with different writers and their home offices. It's half an office and then half of all the sort of collectibles and comics and games and TVs and all that fun stuff. So
exactly.
You know, you got to foster that creativity somehow.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I can sit out here and anywhere I look in any direction, there is something that will spark something either inspiring or motivating, or just being able to look back at the, you know, this big Extant poster that CBS gave me that's, I'll show you behind my wall there. Oh, yeah. That is also kind of like being able to go, oh, hey, I did that. That was cool.
Yeah. And how is the self quarantine, no, the social distancing? How is the social distancing treating you guys? Because you had mentioned that Julie was out of town and now she's back. And so now you're not, I guess, isolated.
Yeah, now we're
But
isolated together.
now you're isolated together. So how's everything
Yeah, it was
going in
kind
your
of crazy
world?
because she's been in Oregon for the last 2.5 months doing Steel Magnolias at a theater up there at the Oregon Cabaret Theater. I actually went to see her last week. I've been busy with a couple of jobs and haven't been able to get up there. And she had taken our pup Ellie up with her for the last few weeks because I was so busy. And then so I was like, well, I'll come up and see the show and then I'll drive Ellie back. We'll take a road trip. I didn't want to fly because I was like, the airports are a
Oh,
little,
yeah.
just because it seems like there's and not even the virus stuff, but like the disruption of schedules and things. I didn't want to be stuck and it's such a short drive. So Ellie and I drove home on Friday, and that was the day I think it took the real serious turn where they were starting to shut everything down and telling people to stay inside and the social distancing. And it was kind of crazy because the first part of the drive back from Oregon is so beautiful because you're like an hour in, you're looking at Mount Shasta, and you're looking at it for like an hour and a half of the drive. There's this like beautiful mountain and it's bright and sunny. And then by the time we got to Stockton, I'd been listening to the news a lot, and we pulled over to walk in a neighborhood there, and it was like a storm was coming in, so wind was blowing. It's like leaves and trash were blowing everywhere. There was a guy walking down the street coughing. So I'm like hyper aware of that. And then two people were sitting in their cars listening to two different radio shows about the virus, listening to talk radio stuff, people talking about the virus. Like, this is 100% that, act one in every dystopia, like the 28 Days Later or like The Walking Dead, it's like that sort of thing. You're just like, this is it. This is what that feels like in the early part of that story. It was so freaky. So then we got home, and so it was just me and Ellie for a couple of days, and I really was just trying to like just go out to the store for a couple things minimally as possible. And but I was able to hike. That's the one thing I've been really kind of doing two things to stay sane until Julie got home. One of them is hiking, which I love, and there are so many great trails around. And so I did one the other day, the Beaudry Loop, which goes up to Tongva Peak over here in these Verdugo Mountains behind Glendale. And it was I think it was a seven, I think it did a 7.4 mile round trip. And it was like 270 some flights of stairs
That's
ultimately, like on the
quite a
health
hike.
app. It was a huge hike and like the dumbest thing to do straight out of the gate. So like so I spent the next couple of days after that recovery. And then I started last year making pizzas, which I've gotten really obsessed with, making my pizzas. And so those are the two things that I've been able to do indoors to entertain myself, in addition to like still having to do some work and things like that. And then Julie got home last night, so I ended up canceling her last week of shows of Steel Magnolias, and then she drove home from Oregon yesterday, got in at 11 o'clock last night. So now we're adapting to both of us being in the house together with the pup.
Right. Well, at least you're both home and safe, and that's the important thing in all
Yeah,
this.
absolutely.
Yeah. What kind of pizzas are you, what's your specialty?
Well, I tell you my favorite one to make right now. I started off learning how to make the sort of traditional Neapolitan style because I was watching a lot of. I'll tell you how it started really quickly, which is I've always loved pizza, like my entire life. When I really sat back to think of it, there are only maybe two or three things that I have loved unequivocally my entire life: movies, television, books, and one of them is pizza, which I've loved since I was a kid. And growing up, there was this place in a regional chain called Giovanni's, which was the kind of thing like you would have every Friday night before the football game at your high school, that kind of stuff, right? And then I moved to Cincinnati, and there was some great pizza there. And then I moved to Chicago for a year, and of course, there's like the deep dish pizza. And then I spent 10, 15 years in New York, and that's the pizza capital of the world. Like that's there's that for me, that's the best. That's still my favorite pizza. And so, but it wasn't until last year that I got interested in making it because we were doing these like make your own pizza nights at the house. And we're having like the family over and friends, and we would just buy a bunch of the pre-made Pillsbury doughs and jarred sauce and a bag of, Kraft shredded mozzarella or whatever. And then all the toppings and just let people make their own. And then I think after two or three times of that, I was like, I can't be that hard to make really good sauce. And so that was like the gateway drug, was learning how to make my own sauce. And then I started watching all these YouTube videos of these Neapolitan pizza makers, and so the next step was the dough, which was super hard. And I think that's the point. I was like, okay, there's a science to this. There's math.
It was math. Oh
yeah. Like, you know, measuring out the ingredients.
Yeah.
A lot of the recipes are in the metric system. So, and then one day, because I started doing that, my mom got me a pizza stone and a couple pans. And then I went out to this Italian market in Pasadena called Roma Market. And it's this awesome little place. And there's this guy in there, Rosario, who's been working there for 50 years. And I told him what I was doing. And I came out to look for some San Marzano tomatoes. And he's like, oh, and he started walking me around the shop. And he pulled the right flour, the double zero flour, mm-hmm. the San Marzano tomatoes. He was giving me like, this is the olive oil you should use to finish. And when I came home and started doing that, that's when it got super serious. And so I started trying to make the Neapolitan, which are really hard on the stone. There's a steep learning curve with the dough and getting it on and off the stone from the peel. I've ruined like more than my fair share of pizzas now. But my favorite one to make now is this like a spicy soppressata, two kinds of mozzarella, and then like red pepper flakes, and then this thing, Mike's Hot Honey. With a little drizzle of that. So it's a little spicy, a little sweet. And that's like my favorite one to make.
Mike's Hot Honey.
Interesting. Mike's Hot Honey. And it's actually the one thing 2 weeks ago when things started getting really dangerous. This was the first night I was like, oh, yeah, this is bad. Because I looked it up, and one of the places, the closest place that was selling it to me was the Burbank Walmart. And I went in there at like 6 p.m. on a Saturday. It was pandemonium. I was like, oh, this is getting out of hand.
Right.
It's one of the last things I ventured out for before it all turned south.
Yeah, it's interesting. Probably, I want to say the beginning of February when I first started being cognizant. I mean, obviously it started in the end of December, and then started mid-January, it started to get serious in China. Yeah. And then probably early February is when I was walking around with my wife in the supermarket, and we were buying, you know, just a little extra here and there. And I was looking around, and I told her, I don't think people realize that what's about to happen. And yeah. I'm no scientist. I don't proclaim to have predicted any of this, but you could kind of tell that if it got loose, it could be really bad.
Yeah.
But it was one of those moments like you see in movies where you see the people walking around and acting like nothing, and you know as the audience that something bad is terrible is about to happen. And it was one of those out-of-body experiences where I was looking at people in the beginning of February, we were buying an extra packet of toilet paper.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, nobody seems to have any idea of what's about to happen. And then we went probably this past weekend, was it this weekend or Friday, I think it was, and it was chaos. A lot of the shelves were empty. You know, we went just to pick up a few things, and the lines, you stood in line for an hour and a half just to check out. It was just a disaster, and it was exactly what you thought it would be. Although it wasn't as, everyone was polite and everyone was friendly, and you know, there was nobody desperate or anything like that. Nobody was fighting over anything. So it was much more civil than you'd see in movies. But
but it's all like degrees, right? Because you're like, I went to the Ralph's the other day, and I walked through and grabbed a couple things, and same thing, like tons of shelves were empty, but they had a few things that I needed, and I thought, well, I could make this tonight or whatever. And I didn't glance at the self-checkout line. I just, you know, I walked past it like in the front aisle and didn't realize until I actually went to get in line that the self-checkout line went all the way up the aisle. So there were like 30 people in the self-checkout line. And I was like, oh yeah, this is not normal. And like you said, everybody was polite and super friendly. In fact, there was a lady who, because I hadn't planned on standing in line for 25 minutes, I didn't have a cart or a little basket. Basket. Thanks for that. And so I was just holding like a bunch of stuff, and I started dropping it. I was around a lady, move some stuff around in her cart, and she was like, hey, would you want to share mine? And you know, little things like that where people were very, you know, helpful and friendly. But it does seem that to me was like, okay, this, what if this is stage two, you know, next stage three is like you stop not being able to get anything, and then it does devolve into the chaos that you see in the movies, and there are people are bartering in the streets for toilet paper, you know, like it's so crazy. But it also is, I mean, it is interesting, like the writer part of me can't help but look around and go, how to think about how many of the dystopic movies and books and things get the details right. Because, you know, if you look, like every church that I pass now has something about the virus, you know, pray for the virus, you know, victims of the virus, things like that. And how it seeps in and affects the fabric of everything, you know, people wearing masks while they're out walking their dog and stuff like that. It's like the people who foresaw this, we did on the final season of The Strain. There was, not to spoil anything, but by the final season, society had been upended. And so the vampires were in charge. Humans were subjugated, and they were restricting access to things. You're only allowed to move certain times of the day. People were having to, you know, barter. They couldn't get oranges for vitamin C. So they were starting to get scurvy again, you know, that sort of stuff. And so even those sorts of things, I remember us writing about, like, there was a whole storyline in one of the first episodes about this character F, who was, you know, the whole journey was about just getting propane to heat up his food and stuff like that, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, what I will say is, being the first person to predict, I'm just kidding. Right. What I will say is, in a sort of a heartening way, that even in the hardest hit parts of Hubei province in China, you know, Wuhan, and even in the northern parts of Italy, where they're obviously the hardest hit, a couple things remain constant. And that's that the power, the water, they all stayed up. You know, the financial system didn't collapse, and it never devolved into what you would see in movies where you think where, you know, again, like people are, you know, doing home invasions to get a bottle of water kind of thing and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, this is obviously a very difficult situation. It's terrible what's going on, but ultimately if you're feeling scared about it, you know, and then thinking you need a shotgun to make sure you protect your canned food and stuff.
Yeah.
Even in the worst hard hit parts, which hopefully this won't get to, hopefully it never devolved into that. So,
well, that's why so many of those stories are about retaining your humanity even in those times.
Right.
that is the lesson about a lot of those stories is, even, you know, when it comes to that point, which obviously we're not there, but in a lot of those stories, when it comes to that point, like what are you willing to kill for? What are you willing to die for? And how do you hold on to your humanity when people are sort of, you know, devolving into the worst versions of ourselves. And I mean, that's one of the things kind of where you were talking about just now too, with in addition to like the water and the power. But I've talked to so many of my neighbors, and we've traded numbers, and people that I've known and have talked to, but we've never gone to that level of like, hey, let me get your cell phone, please call me if you need anything, if there's anything I can do, and vice versa. And so that, I think the spirit of people helping each other, that part of it is still so heartening and gives me so much hope.
Yeah. And also, I mean, with the free time that I think a lot of people have, it's nice to reach out to friends you hadn't spoken to in a long time and have them reach out to you just, hey, checking in, because you know, life gets in the way. And so sometimes you just don't think about it. You're like, oh, I should talk to such and such. And yet, oh, well, I have to do this. I have to do this. I'll do it next week. And then that turns into 6 months. So,
yeah, I'm terrible about that. I mean, I'd say of like my whole group of friends, I'm probably the worst person to reach out to other people just out of the blue and be like, hey, how's it going? Because we were talking a little bit about this before, but because I'm a writer and because I tend to sort of value my own isolation, I have a certain number of hours a day that I kind of need to be by myself, even if I'm not actually just writing. It's time to process or to read or to think, and so I have grown pretty comfortable with that over the last 25 years, and so it's So I realized that about myself over the last couple of years that I have friends. As I get older, you start to lose touch more and more. And now it's a year that you go between talking to them or seeing them. And I need to be better about reaching out to them. And so it has having this like pause in life has done exactly that, which, you know, make me maybe think about those friendships and reach out to those people and want to talk to them more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so how are you spending? Well, obviously, now that Julie's back, it's probably a little bit different. You'll probably have to share the remote, although you've got your own office. You can watch whatever you want. But what
yeah,
are you
exactly.
What are you watching now, film, TV? What are you reading book-wise to, you know, sort of kill those extra hours that you've got that you're not
yeah.
working?
Well, I mean, what's kind of interesting about this period of time is that the – well – one of the things that kind of struck me that I didn't really realize until Saturday, I got an email on Saturday from, I think it was Saturday, from my college. I went to school at this conservatory of music in Cincinnati, and they do a showcase every year for the seniors that they take to New York, where you put together the show that you do for agents, and it's all in the sort of hopes of getting signed. Do it for casting directors, and it's really about introducing you to the town. And so I did a showcase when I was a graduate. I think my class was maybe the second or third to go to New York with their showcase. And so it's a big deal every year. You're working towards it. You're basically your whole 4 years that you're there is working up to this moment. And unfortunately, the kids this year, these seniors, may have their New York trip canceled. I mean, I'm sure by this point probably is canceled. And so they sent out this thing to all the alumni, which, hey, we're live streaming the senior showcase from the theater at school. And we want to just get as many people to watch as possible. And so I jumped on to watch it Saturday, and there were a ton of other alumni, people I've been friends with, people I haven't talked to in a long time. And we were all watching it together and like chatting on the side. And so all of a sudden there was this sort of impromptu live event that was and super inspiring because these kids are unbelievably talented. And so much of it is, there was so much heart to it because they really are celebrating 4 years of hard work, and they're celebrating their potential, and they're celebrating the power of art in general. But then you're also watching it, and you're having this great communal experience in real time. And that was something that I should have probably seen that coming, but didn't, that type of thing would be happening more and more. And then this friend of mine, Shoshana Bean, that does a, weekly show at the Standard, and I've gone to see it a few times, and she's always amazing. She was one of the Elphabas on Broadway in Wicked, and now she has her own like whole recording career. But she did a virtual concert last night on this thing called Stage It, and it was the same thing. She did it basically, I think, from her house. She had a bunch of guests and live streamed the whole thing, and there were people chatting, all of her fans in a sidebar, and commenting on the songs and the guests and things like that too. And it was this communal experience. That's been really cool. And I think that we're probably going to see a lot more of that as the weeks go by, because even though I'm a digital hoarder. So my list, like my queue on Netflix and Disney Plus and all that is just like jam packed with stuff. That type of thing is really appealing. In fact, there might be a lot more of these kind of concerts or, and I have a play that I wrote called Replica, and I was talking to Julie. I wrote it for Julie and her twin sister to do. And I was like, hey, we should do like a live table read of Replica, just live stream it. And we can have a, you know, Q&A for it, because a lot of our friends and family, they had a world premiere at this theater in Houston, at Stages Repertory Theater in Houston in 2018. But a lot of our friends and family couldn't make it. So it'd be kind of cool for them to see it. Even if there were only 30 or 40 people watching, it's a detour from what they'd normally be doing. So there's that. So I also watched, to answer your question, I've seen the first couple episodes of Amazing Stories, which I'll admit to be a little biased because I was in a mini room for that when it first started. But I've loved that on Apple. The McDonald's, the McMillions, is that what it's called? The documentary
right.
on HBO.
HBO, yeah.
Super fascinating. I'm really excited about both The Invisible Man and The Hunt coming to video on demand this week, because I think that those are two movies that I've seen. The Invisible Man, I loved it, but Julie hasn't seen it yet, so I'm sure we're going to watch that. And then The Hunt, I was been incredibly excited to see because of Betty Gilpin, so I'm super excited to see that too. What about you? What are you watching? What are you reading?
Well, right now, at least, I guess my self isolation slash, I keep saying that, and I know it's social distancing, really started on Monday, I guess. For the weekend was, the weekend, and as of Friday, things were still sort of moving. So I really haven't had time to sort of catch up on anything just yet. And I've sort of switched the podcast over to a daily from a weekly, which is obviously a substantial amount of work, but I thought this might be fun for other writers to all sort of share our communal experiences. So what have I been watching? I was late to the game, and this is not has nothing to do with the extra free time based on social isolation. Although also with social distancing, I should say, is when you have a 6-year-old, it becomes much less social distancing as
I'm
much as it
sure.
is, entertaining your child, who's awesome, by the way. I love my son, but it becomes a lot. You don't have as much free time as you think, and so. But I mean, I was late to the game on Chernobyl. That was on my list for a long time, so I finally got to watch that, the whole series, and it's a masterpiece. It is
Yeah, I still
brilliant.
haven't seen it yet. It's on my list.
Oh my gosh, Mickey! There's few things in life that I watch that I think it's. You don't have suggestions like I would have changed this or I would have made this different or
Right.
you're watching it and like oh okay maybe this part wasn't as this thing you just watched it's 5 episodes I think you just watch it and you're just like wow you're just blown away how what a great job Craig Mazin and I don't remember the name of the director but they did a fantastic job with that.
Isn't that awesome? Like when you watch something like that, and it just overrides that part of your brain
Yeah.
that is the part of your brain that knows how the sausage is made, and you just enjoy it for what it is. And I think that's such a gift when you get to those kind of things. It's one of like I was talking to some friends recently about, by the way, the two people making pizzas with and talking about making pizzas with are Heath Corson and Ben Blacker. And
Oh,
they're two,
okay.
so they both make pizzas themselves. And they're the ones who have given me these, given me the tips, and they gave me a certain book to get called Pizza Camp, which I've been working out of with a lot of these recipes. And but I was talking to them about I think my top three favorite movies of last year were all had that same experience. So number one was Parasite. Number two was this movie called First Love. It was a Miike movie, and then Uncut Gems. And because and they were just like so engrossing and so like had you on your seat of like what's going to happen next, that it just totally shut down the part of my brain that hadn't that could even think critically about any of it. And they were so surprising that a midway through the movie, I was like, I have absolutely no idea how this is going to end. Like that, and that's a pretty rare thing too. Like if like when you go see Avengers Endgame, it's fun and I love those movies, but you know that Thanos isn't going to win in the end, right? So right away, there's a whole category of things that are not going to happen. But with those three movies, I was like, I have absolutely no idea. It's beyond my ability to guess where this is going, and that was such a fun experience to have because it shut my writer brain off and it just made me a fan and an audience member.
And the thing with Chernobyl is most of us have heard of Chernobyl. You kind of know that it was a nuclear power plant that melted down in Russia, but you don't really have an understanding of what happens. And certainly, there's no hero that's going to stop the plant from melting down. It's not like, it's a movie with Dwayne Johnson or something like that. You sort of know the backstory, and yet you're still so engrossed, and you learn so much. And like those disaster movies that we talk about, that you learn about humanity, and you learn about so much about the human spirit, and it's really a tremendous piece of filmmaking. And it's one of those things like you watch things, at least I do, watch things, and you're like, oh, I aspire to make something that good one day. But then certain things just even transcend that. And to me, at least, other people may disagree, but for me, you look at this and like, I don't think I'll make anything as good as this in my lifetime. I don't think I thought it was that
That's
strong.
excellent. Well, yeah, but the great thing is it sets that bar. You're like, hey, you've got a bar to aspire to.
Well, what's that old saying? Aim for the stars, and if you don't succeed, at least you'll end up on the moon or something like
Yeah,
that.
exactly, exactly.
So I wanted to ask you about what was I? Oh, for those who you had mentioned this before, for those who are unfamiliar with the term mini room. Maybe you can explain that because we still do talk about writing and stuff on the show. So,
Yeah. I mean, I think it's happening more and more these days, where a lot of times,
The
especially I
room
think
before the room.
the room before the room, I think a lot of the cable and the streaming services, you know, they may buy the pitch from the writer will order, the writer will write the pilot, rather than go off and make a pilot, the buyer will, put together a room, order, you know, like a mini room to put together more episodes, and then ultimately decide if they want to make the series or not. And so I think there are a number of ways it can happen. Like that's one, which is, hey, we bought the pilot. We really like this. We like the format. We're going to put this room together, and this mini room is going to come together and brainstorm a bunch of ideas for the series. So, like, say for Amazing Stories, that first 3 weeks was basically, you know, a number of writers coming together, because it's an anthology show, and our job for those 3 weeks was just to come up with as many ideas for episodes as possible. And then after that 3 weeks, they whittled it down, and then they put it together, you know, the full room for breaking those individual stories and handing out episodes, that sort of thing. So I think there are a number of ways it can happen. And then I was recently in a mini room that was about helping to break a season-long arc and sort of broad strokes for the format itself. So I think it's happening more and more that way these days, because I think with the cable and streaming, the go off and make a pilot model is just, they're just not doing that as much. And so it is like, before we bet the farm on, you know, millions of dollars on making this whole series, let's get these scripts in shape first, and then we'll order or not. I mean, the downside of that is you could spend a year in a room and come up with 10 scripts and then have it not go forward, which can be really heartbreaking, I'm sure. If you spend all that time and you fall in love with these characters and you've put so much work into it and time and expectations, the plus side is if it does go forward, hey, you've got these like 10 great scripts that everybody's on the same page about. And you've had a year of work, you know? So that's, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are writers who are very pro this sort of process, and the writers who are very anti, because, you know, for various reasons, like it's, they're shorter seasons. It means that maybe you're trying to like cobble together two or three different jobs a year or four different jobs a year, as opposed to like just having one, you know, if you're on a 22 episode show and a, you know, broadcast network, you're working for, you know, 20, 22 weeks, 30 weeks. So.
And you had mentioned the book Pizza Camp. What other kind of books are you reading that aren't necessarily pizza and or food related? Or even that. Yeah, that's fine too. What sort of books are you reading?
Well,
Anything?
I'll tell you, I've actually got this book right here. One of the writers on The Strain, this guy David Weddle, wrote the definitive book on Sam Peckinpah called "If They Move, Kill 'Em." And we he so he was a journalist as well, an author. And while we were working on The Strain, he gave me this book about Peckinpah, and I've seen a bunch of his movies and really love them. Like, you know, certainly The Wild Bunch, one of my all-time favorite movies. So I think my project starting sometime this week is going to be to work my way through this book and stop and watch the movies as they come up. And so that's one. I'm trying to think what else I've got. Oh, this is kind of like, I pick this up a lot. This is the Twilight Zone 19 original stories on the 50th anniversary. It's a bunch of short stories by some really great authors, R.L. Stine, Timothy Zahn, a bunch of people like that, edited by Carol Serling, who put together that book. So I've been reading that. Let's see. I have a book of Elmore Leonard short stories that I've been reading. And then you know, it's crazy because I buy so many books. And this is really like, I'm not only a digital hoarder, but I'm like a little bit of a book hoarder. I can't go into a bookstore and not come out with one or two books, and then I just don't have the time to read them all.
Right. No, I mean, yeah, I get it.
until now. Yeah, I mean, some of these I don't want to tell you about because it might be IP that somebody's going to steal, and I just haven't got it to it
That's fair
yet.
enough.
I'm just looking around. Oh, I did go back to like started reading Kabuki again, that David Mack Kabuki, which is one of my favorite graphic novels, series of graphic novels. Yeah, so that's a lot of it. I'm trying to look around my office here and see what's kind of out in the on deck position that I've been picking up, and some of them are inside. Some of them are moved. Oh, I tell you, one of my favorite books I read last year, and I did the same sort of thing, which is I kind of read it with my laptop in hand, which is this book about Prince and the Purple Rain era sessions.
Okay.
And basically, the author took all of the studio notes and like the studio logs day by day of when they were recording, so from the end of 1999 through the recording of Purple Rain, and went back and interviewed tons of people and told a bunch of the stories about the making of the movie and the recording, and then there are all these live performances he talks about and B-sides and things that got cut and remixes. And so I read that book with my laptop in hand, and then as I would get to somebody like, "Oh, I never saw that," I would pull it up and watch the clip or listen to the song, and so that's fun. So for a music fan, I think that's a great one that really stuck with me after all this time.
Oh, that's cool.
What about you? What are you reading?
What's my son reading basically right now? Let's see. The last good book I read. Oh, actually, I have to probably grab it. I don't know the name, but I just ordered a book on cyber warfare because I do think it's sort
Yeah.
of super interesting how we live in an era where a lot of wars are being fought that we don't even see and understand. Because I just heard today that, or just saw today that Russia is sowing seeds of discontent and attempting
Yeah.
to cause a panic in the US by, putting out rumors in social media and things about how bad this is or how bad it's getting or whatever. And this is a constant thing between states, the constant warring of different nations, and the propaganda machines. And it's made so easy because of the connectedness and, in terms of social media and things like that, to develop propaganda in other countries. I don't know the name of the book. I'll have to sort of look it up. It's on my nightstand now. I just got it.
Yeah, I've
So.
got one of those here too that I read, and I keep it handy for research and for inspiration too. It's called Future War, Preparing for the New Global Battlefield by Robert H. Lattef, and it is, yeah, it's a lot of that stuff. There's a lot of cyber warfare in there. It talks a lot about augmentation, sort of, biologically enhanced soldiers, that sort of thing. And so anybody who's writing that sort of science fiction, it's a really great book for just for sort of, inspiration and a look from somebody who's in the trenches of military strategy and talking about where we might be headed with all that stuff. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, oh, I grabbed the one that I have. And I haven't read the whole thing. I'm only a part way into it, maybe 20, 30 pages into it. It's called Dark Territory: The Secret History of
Ooh.
Cyber War by Fred Kaplan. So,
That sounds cool.
yeah. I do have a couple questions that listeners had sent. The first being from James Writes Things. He wanted to know, what's one thing in an upcoming writer's TV sample that shows, quote, they get this right away? And what's one thing that shows they don't? Like, what pops in a script for you? Like, when you read a sample from somebody, is there anything in particular that, sort of makes you take note right away, and or something that shows you that they just don't get it right
Yeah,
away?
I mean, to me, the thing that jumps out to me now is it's sort of like the same answer for both questions, which is emotional point of view. And this is something that I learned. I didn't learn really until I broke in with Extant and watching other people do it, which is really putting you in the subjective emotional viewpoint of your character. And really taking you through how they feel about things and how they're thinking, because I tend to think in pretty dry terms of, the action. This happens, then this happens, then this happens, and then two things happen when I with right around the time I was writing Extant, my girlfriend was in grad school for acting, and she was doing going through this Stanislavski training. And one of the stages, there are these different elements, sort of foundational principles from the Stanislavski method. And one of them was appraisal. and it is something happens that, and you know, the character reacts to it. It's like your mom has passed away and you're going through all of her things and you find a picture of her with a man who isn't your father. Right. And so that moment for a character, if this is in the first 10 minutes of your movie, you have to talk about if that's a big event, you have to talk about what that emotional experience is doing for your actor in a way that isn't just like directing, the actor. So it's not just like, she grimaces. It's not giving her, specific like physical direction to play, but it is sort of creating the feeling of what that character is thinking and giving the actor something to work from. So the actor goes, oh, I know how to play that moment. If it's like this feeling that she's just unearthed this like terrible secret. It's like that. And so when I see a writer who is able to pull me into the character's like emotional point of view, that all of a sudden everything kind of lifts off the page. The stakes are higher because I really feel it through the character. And if a writer doesn't do that, then it tends to be sort of dry and plot driven, and I stop caring about the what happens to the character fairly early on. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's a big thing. And then I think the other thing that I'm looking for is when I'm reading it, is there a moment that is either inventive enough, creative enough, that it seems like only this writer would have come up with it. That is so,
gotcha.
I'm trying to think of like a great moment in, in those movies I talked about. I mean, Parasite's just like, filled with them, right? Like the little thing when, the brother and sister, when they stop at the door, mm-hmm. and she's like, and she does her, oh, Jessica, Illinois, oh, yeah. like that thing is so, it's such a small, tiny detail. A character detail where she stops him and she's like, wait, let's go over this again. It's expositional, so it tells you they've been rehearsing this, but they do it in such a fun character way, which is they learned it via song. Right. they've sung to each other back and forth. That kind of moment, I think, to me as a reader, is like, oh, I'm in good hands. Yeah, I'm right. in hands of somebody who knows what they're doing. So, right. That's, I would say those are two of my biggest things.
They're fumigating the street again. Close the windows. Yes. No, leave them open because you can get rid of the stink bugs.
Yeah. Even the opening shot of that movie, and this is something I think about a lot for myself, because I try to think of this in every script that I write now too. Like, what is the very first image that you see? I think Spielberg talks about this too.
Right.
The importance of like the very first thing that you see, and the very first image of that are like the socks hanging from a light fixture.
Yeah.
And right away it's like, put you in a place, put you in a time, and he comes back to that motif throughout. And it's, even the second that movie started, I was like, this is going to be great.
Right They understand storytelling and
yeah,
world building and stuff like that, world building in a sense of not even science fiction-y, but you understand aspects of the characters, like you said, from socks on the light or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is so simple and yet so informative.
Yeah, and so visual storytelling.
That's what it is. Yeah. Here's another one for you from Guns the Gamer. I'd really like to know his thoughts on productions coming to Ohio. Is the industry there ripe for them? I feel like it's a relatively untapped market with good tax incentives, mostly for film, but TV could go there as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I would have thought that there would be more of it too by this point. It's funny because I actually don't really know about the current situation with the tax incentives, because I remember a few years ago the governor voted against them, or at least I thought they did. So my memory of it was that it wasn't as enticing as some of these other states who are really trying to be aggressive in pulling filmmakers there. Say like Louisiana, or Georgia, those kind of places.
Right.
I think the two other things are, there are a lot of really talented people, but there may not be the infrastructure there to support it. So say like, for instance, in Atlanta now, you have, Tyler Perry has whole film studios, and there are people who live there on the ground. A lot of people who just moved there because they're working there full time. So you can crew up pretty easily.
And they have sound stages and equipment houses and...
Yeah, so there's a lot of infrastructure there to support it. And so And I think that just takes, you know, one or two people coming in and planting the, you know, planting the flag and starting to build that up. Like even Louisiana, like I have friends who have moved to Louisiana who were working in production because there was just a lot of work there. And so now if production goes there, it's probably pretty easy for them to staff up because they've, you know, they know they're these grips. They've worked on these shows. They've worked on they're sort of proven talent. And so, and like I said, I mean, there's a huge talent pool in Ohio. I have tons of friends who are filmmakers there. They're absolutely people who can do the jobs. But it just may not be like the breadth of it may not be as wide to support big productions coming there
right
now. But I will say this, there are, depending on the show, there you can be in the cities in Columbus, Cincinnati, you can be in the mountains, you can be in the hills, you can be in small town America. So I think there's a lot of bang for your buck in terms of being able to point the camera somewhere and creating a time and place.
Right.
I love Ohio. I wish there was more of it there.
Yeah. And I remember on Twitter, just, I don't remember how long ago it was, you posted sort of a writing prompt or an idea prompt about the little library with the note inside of a book.
Oh, yeah.
Which I can't remember exactly what it said, but it was sort of a lead off in terms of like coming up with an idea of where this could go. Maybe you could explain a little bit about explain the concept a little bit better than I did, which was pretty terrible, actually.
Oh, no. You're doing perfectly fine.
And then, what idea, like, did any of the ideas? And if so, which ideas sort of stood out to you that you thought, oh, this is fun?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So the way that started is I take my dog to a few different parks. And in the couple of the parks, they have little free libraries. And there are some up in the neighborhood that I go walking around in Glendale, up near in Kenneth Village. There are a couple of people actually have little free libraries at the edge of their lawn.
Yeah, it's like a little box.
It's like a little box. Yeah. For anybody who's listening who doesn't know, because I don't know if they have them everywhere, but it's like a little box that is filled with books that people have donated. And you can just walk up, you can take a book, you can leave a book. And so my... One day when I was walking Ellie, this is probably like a year ago, saw it. And I was just, as I was thinking about it, I was thinking about somebody who they're always like spy novels and stuff in there too. And I was like, hey, wouldn't it be interesting if somebody came to get a spy novel and there was a note in the spy novel that said, you know, call for your next assignment. And there was a number. And so that kind of became my like exercise for fun when I was walking Ellie and I would see it and I would go, okay, where would I take the story today? Like, what would be the new thing? And so I remembered I saw it the other day, and then I put that Twitter prompt out on Twitter, and got a lot of great responses. And it's interesting because a lot of people, some people took it differently than it was in my head, but there are a couple variations that were that came up a number of times. One, which is the note was intended for mom. So the idea is like a young woman. She's taking care of her mother. Her mother's in hospice. And yeah, basically every day, like maybe while the nurses are changing shifts, she takes a walk to the park, swaps out a book for a new book, you know, something to do while passing the time while she's taking care of her mom. And then one day she finds this note, your assignment. And then she either calls the number or she doesn't, something happens, right? So there were a number of common responses, which was mom was a super spy. And that she discovers this whole life about her mom, which I love that because what's sort of interesting is kind of like we were talking about earlier, like you find that you're a parent had a whole secret life that you didn't know anything about. And particularly like this, you know, this lady in hospice who may, you know, who's sort of dying and weakened and then discovering that she was this, you know, powerful operative who may have had the ability to change the fate of nations is super awesome. You know, like that's a cool idea. And then there was others that were like, oh, it's a secret society. And then some were like, this is one that I came up with pretty early on too, which my initial thing was really, there are only two ways that this can go. One is like mistaken identity. And she calls the number and then gets drawn into this plot. And the other was that ultimately it's like the game kind of setup where somebody is like setting her up to do this. So there was that too, but there were some really creative responses there that I thought, I'm trying to think of my favorite. My friend Jason Jenkins, Jinx nickname, he sent me one that was pretty great, which was, let me see if I can pull that up here. If you don't mind, give me just one second. because I think he had a pretty interesting one that had a couple of those elements to it, but it was like it was a little too hard for him to pull it into the whole thing. Oh, it was like a Winter Soldier type thing where she calls the number and somebody gives her a code word and then she's activated and then she does something that she has no knowledge of and then discovers that she's, which I thought that was super cool too.
Yeah, I think I would have, when I read that initially, I didn't actually, obviously when you have a 6-year-old, you're dragged in many different directions, but I was going to respond to something. Mine would have been probably a comedy of where you get the call for your next assignment and the person, you know, the woman calls and misinterprets the message there. And it's literally like some school teacher leaving an assignment, but it's ambiguous enough that the woman takes it and runs with it and becomes her own sort of secret agent and goes on these missions, you know,
that's great.
That interconnect sort of in a coincidental way. And people would say, that doesn't make sense. Too many big buys, but I don't know. I thought that would have been kind of fun anyway.
That would have been very fun. Yeah. There was one that, I can't remember who, I can't pull it up at the moment, but there was a writer that she had one that I was like, oh, this is, it would totally be like a great Melissa McCarthy or, you know, like one of those kind of things where she, you know, gets pulled into some, you know, great action comedy adventure like that. I think ultimately like where I kept going was sort of more straightforward. It's like she calls the number and then she's like, this is stupid. And she hangs up before the person answers. And then the next day she goes out to get the mail and there's a phone in the mailbox and it's like too late. If you're, you know, like you've already learned too much about us. And so, so that she would be really pulled into something that was a little more, I don't, because there was a part of me that over the last year has been obsessed with trying to find a type of 3 Days of the Condor or a Parallax View kind of modern conspiracy theory kind of thing. For myself, just because I love those movies and I think the time is ripe for them.
Yeah, it's very prescient today.
Very prescient. My worry is that with like I think the thing that keeps me from diving into it wholeheartedly is because of the whole like Q phenomenon. And I think telling a story right now where there is an actual conspiracy, you right under the people's noses, might, you know, even if you inadvertently fan the flames of that or validate that, it's like there's a part of it. It's like, do I really want to tell that kind of story? I don't know. Yeah.
Right.
But I love those movies. And I think that especially with the modern technology, the way that they are, one of the stories I've been obsessed with, over the last year. So remember the story about all those, people in the embassy in Cuba who were hearing that sound?
Oh, right.
They started to get sick, right? You know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And they thought it might have been like a sonic weapon that was aimed at them. And then there was a whole explanation that came out, which was like, no, this was just sort of like mass delusion that somebody had had thought they had it, and they started talking about it. And so so then everybody thought they had it. Which I was like, well, that doesn't make sense, right? doesn't seem possible. So I think with technology these days, there's an opportunity to tell a really cool story like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I appreciate you spending the time with us. I don't want to take up your whole day.
There's
hiking and books and other things to get to.
That's great. I'm enjoying talking to you. So we can, don't worry. We can go as long as you want to, but if you're ready to do it, I'm ready to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, do you have any other sort of, not necessarily advice, but what other kind of things are you self doing that quality of life, self-improvement, care, like hiking? What other things do you have planned during this long that we're supposed to social distance ourselves from others?
I'll tell you this. I think my three things are, I'm getting outside and staying active, because the idea that with the hiking or like biking, getting out to walk the dog, that you could still, like, you're not around other people. And so like when I went up the mountain the other day, there were tons of people hiking, but you know, we were plenty of distance from each other. But everybody was in good spirits and waving and encouraging. And in fact, like on my way up, I was like an hour into it and I was like, this is it. I got to turn around. And there were two guys coming up on bikes at different times. And both of them were like, you're doing great, man. You got this, buddy. You know? And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to keep going. And so that kind of encouragement was like, got me to the top of the mountain. So I think that's sort of great on all those fronts. But the other thing is, I mean, to me, it's just like, if you're in a good position to help other people in any capacity, because, you know, like I have a neighbor who, she is the loveliest lady. I think, I'm assuming she's in like her 70s, but every morning she's out like cleaning, she's picking up leaves up the street, and like, she'll come and pick them from our side of the street. And, she is as sweet as she can be. And I know that, you know, it's probably harder for her to get out. So I went over the other day and gave her my cell phone number and Julie's cell phone number and said, if there's anything that you need, and then we'll call you if we're going out to pick up stuff so we can bring it back. So it's reaching out to help other people, you know, seeing what Liz Alper did. Before the podcast, I was looking, she raised almost $200,000 mm-hmm. for support personnel, support staff. That sort of thing is taking this opportunity to just make sure that we've got each other's backs, I think is a way to keep, to stay positive. I mean, it's always a great thing to put yourself in service to other people because it takes the focus off of yourself. Yeah. Right. And so it's like, I think that's a way to stay mentally and emotionally healthy too, is just to like, if you, is to be the helpers that Mr. Rogers talked about, you know? Yeah. So those are the big things. And yeah, taking care of myself, you know, like, I started a routine where I make overnight oats basically every night, probably like 5 days a week. I have those with fruit and oat milk. And then that's like, I know if I at least do that first thing in the morning, I've done one healthy thing for the day.
Right.
So that's it. Yeah. And then just like hanging out with the dog. I think, I mean, it's my little buddy. She's sitting over here right now. She's getting in her bed, but, yeah. Playing hide and seek. And that's the thing. I play with her like I'm a kid.
Yeah.
And it keeps me feeling like I'm a 10-year-old again. Like, we play hide and seek for, you know, a half an hour, a few times a week. And we play fetch every day.
That's great.
We go walking and stuff. And so, yeah, it keeps my spirits up. So yeah, I think that's a big part of it. How about you? What's your secret? What else are you doing? I know you have a kid. So like you said, it's like a lot of the energy is just going into just making sure that they're fed and healthy and all that.
And entertained during this time, you know.
Entertained, yeah.
Yeah, the other stuff is obviously still remains the same, but yeah, just the entertainment, because they no longer go to school and spend as much time in school with friends. And you can't even set up play dates. You can't, I mean, they're just kind of cooped up. So yeah, I mean, we've taken them for walks and we're going to take them for a hike probably later in the week. And, you know, getting outdoors, that's like you'd said, you can still go outside. You can still have your windows open. You just try to maintain a distance between you and other people, physical distance, even if not sort of emotional and social distance, but.
Hey, by the way, I don't know if you saw this or not, but Josh Gad mm-hmm. is reading stories to kids. I'm not sure. I can't remember the exact time. It might be doing it at like 4:30 p.m. our time. But it's great. He was reading like Dr. Seuss books and stuff. And so if your kid is a Frozen fan, if your kid loves Olaf, that'd be a fun one to entertain.
Yeah, no, I saw something about that on Twitter. I'll have to look into that. It's either that or Seth Rogen live tweeting about cats plays high, cats. Something like that, you know.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was great.
So what are you going to live tweet?
That's a great question. yeah, great question. I don't know. I feel like maybe there's something when The Hunted comes out or something like that, too, trying to arrange a group of people to watch it together and at least having like a little screening party where we can all talk about it.
Yeah.
I went to see Cats. By the way, I had two friends in town beginning of January, and we went to see Cats at the Burbank AMC 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a musical theater person. I loved Cats, the musical, growing up. And certainly it was one of the first Broadway shows I ever saw when I went to New York with my high school. And so my two other friends are both friends from the musical theater world. And they were here. It was their last night. And I said, hey, let's go see it. And we heard a lot about it. It had been out for a while. And I was like, we'll go see the 6:51. There are tons of tickets. So if they're out doing stuff during the day, and I said, don't worry, we'll just get tickets when we get to the box office. It's like, it's not sold out by any stretch. So they were kind of running late. I was like, well, let's go to the 9:51 instead. And then I looked on Fandango and it was almost sold out, which should have been like my first clue that this is going to be an unusual experience. So the 9:50 almost sold out. I got us three tickets. It was like a Friday night, I think. and we went there. It was absolutely packed. Mm-hmm. Many, many drunk or stone people there. And the Sonic the Hedgehog trailer came on, and people were like yelling out lines from the Sonic the Hedgehog trailer. I looked at my friend. I was like, I have a feeling this is going to be like a great audience to see this with.
Yeah.
And then the lights went down for the movie to start, and people started chanting cats, 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 cats. And it just grew. And I looked at my friend. I was like, we are never going to forget this for the rest of our lives. And it was true. It was like an absolutely insane screening. People were singing along and clapping. It was great. It was super fun. Again, like a very communal kind of experience that you're lucky to have.
Yeah.
Every once in a while.
For all the people who went to go see Cats on Broadway and couldn't do that during the show.
Exactly. Exactly. Somebody was tweeting about it, and they said that they thought that Darren Criss, who was in like a lot of the American Horror Story and stuff, that he might have been behind some of this, that he was there that night.
Oh.
And as we were leaving the auditorium, there was a sing-along of the entire audience of Mr. Mistopheles. So, and I think I found out later that he might have been leading that too, which is yeah. So I basically had a live tweeting of Cats already.
No, that's great. That's awesome. And like you said, you won't forget that. That's awesome.
I'll never forget that night for the rest of my life.
Yeah. On that note, thanks again for chatting, Mickey. I hope, take some more hikes. Maybe we'll run into each other. Although you live on the east side and we're on the west side. So.
Yeah, I don't know. What's your favorite hike over there on the west side?
We usually go to like Santa Monica Mountains.
Yeah.
You know, Malibu, Creek State Park, stuff like that.
Yeah, some great hikes over there.
Yeah. So to all you guys listening, remember, you're not alone. We're all in this together. And please stay safe, be well, and we will see you tomorrow.